This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Welcome. The title of tonight's installment is Race and Genetics, Part 1. And this will probably be two or possibly three parts. I had intended for this topic to be an extension of the previous topic that I've been talking about, the racial roots of Europeans, but to focus on the biological, the science, and more of a, I don't know, an evidentiary, another form of evidence of the reality of race and what Europeans have in common with each other. But as I investigated and started digging into this about what to talk about and how to approach it, I saw that there was a large ground that I wanted to prepare first. And I hope you'll bear with me. I think this is interesting stuff. What I'm going to talk about here is a vast topic, really. Even though biology is only a subset of science as a whole, and genetics is only a subset of biology, and race is only a subset of genetics, what's left to talk about is still vast. And that's why it's going to take me several installments here. And even so, I'm only going to cover it at a very high level. I'm going to hit the high points and make the points I think need to be made in terms of white racial interests. Prior to the rise of the rigorous kind of science that we're familiar with in modern, what you'd call modern-day science, based on the scientific method, in classical times, in terms of this topic, before, say, the 1800s, even prior to the 1700s, maybe, that the essence of inheritance was understood, but it was understood in a metaphorical sense. I mean, from observation, people had already figured out that traits were passed on from parents to their offspring. They didn't know how exactly that was done, and they used to express this idea in terms of blood. And metaphorically speaking, in terms of blood and bloodlines. But it was not just something that they pulled out of thin air. It was from their experience with animal husbandry, the domestication of animals, breeding, and especially if you're motivated to breed strong animals suited to a particular purpose. All sorts of domestic animals were treated to this sort of rough science of animal husbandry. Horticulture and agriculture are another example of raising crops. I mean, the simple innovation of using some of the best seed for planting rather than for eating provides the long-term benefits of a stronger crop. And fermenting and brewing is another, you could call it a subset of agriculture, but specifically the yeast cultures that before anyone understood what yeast really was, that it was a life form, that it was a microorganism, they understood that different types of yeast could be cultured and produce different quality bread or fermented liquids. So anyway, this stage of human understanding was based on empiricism, and that actually became the cornerstone of science. This together with a theory or hypothesis, followed by experiments to figure out whether the hypothesis was correct or not, and then modify the theory if necessary based on the results of that experiment. This is how science came to be and what science is. The story here in this installment and the subsequent ones that I'm going to talk about is a parade of eminent and distinguished men from history and the positions that they held, the thoughts that they had, the theories that they had. And these men, every one of them that I'm going to mention, is a genius and is accepted as a genius by his peers who are geniuses. Men who the word that recurs over and over again is polymath, somebody who is talented not just in one narrow field, but is a Renaissance man, somebody who has mastered many areas, and in many of these cases is considered the father of a whole branch of modern study of modern science. And the underlying point here is that all of these men accepted some version of race as reality. They didn't deny that race existed or that it was significant. They disagreed about certain aspects of the genetics behind it and the biology behind it and what race is, and I'll get into that a little bit too, but they didn't think that it didn't exist or wasn't significant. And that's in stark contrast to the political zeitgeist today, the political regime in power today. It tells whites, at least, that race doesn't matter and isn't significant. Ultimately, and just to give you a peek up ahead of what's coming toward the end, is DNA, and that's the culmination of the science behind genetics. And that investigation of DNA and the mapping of it and its structure ultimately also supports the notion of race, any notion of race. And there, I've emphasized before in previous installments where I've talked about race as a continuum. It's not really just a black and white, coarse-grained idea. Race is really a finer grained idea as well. I mean, it's and everything in between. A contemporary writer named Steve Saylor has defined race in a very simple way. He calls it, I'll just quote him here a little bit, a racial group is an extended family that is inbred to some degree. That's it, just an extended family that's somewhat inbred. There's no need to say how big the extended family has to be or just how inbred. So he is, that's basically, maybe that's where I got the idea, but that's a very fine-grained, but it's also flexible enough that it can also encompass the larger or coarser-grained idea of race as well in the same definition. There is actually a Wikipedia page titled Race and Genetics, it turns out. After I determined what I was going to talk about, I started searching around for resources that I could quote and get some information from. And this page is kind of useless on its own. It's not. It didn't strike me as trying to demonize race at all. But what it does try to do is water it down and say that it's basically only the coarse-grained definition. And it says, in part, today it is possible to determine by genetic analysis the geographic ancestry of a person and the degree of ancestry from each region. Such analyses can point can pinpoint the migrational history of a person's ancestors with a high degree of accuracy. Well, here they're just using the euphemism geographic ancestry to mean what has previously been called race, or at least the coarse-grained idea of race, this idea that blacks and Africans are a race, and whites from Europe are a race, and yellows from Asia are a race, and the browns or reds from North America or the Americas are another race. And it's considered, I guess, some sort of attack on the whole idea of racism that people can't agree whether there's three races or five races or seven races, or as I've said, that race is a continuous concept. I don't see the logic behind that, that the idea that people disagree about it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's like saying that because there is a continuum in the colors of the rainbow, that blue doesn't exist or red doesn't exist. And just because there's a blending between the colors, it doesn't mean that the individual pure colors don't exist. Although the concept of purity is perhaps controversial, because we're talking about here the difference between individual people and collectives, averages of those collectives. We'll get into that a little bit here in some of the further discussion. So as I say, this idea of geographic ancestry, this is sometimes used as this is the modern day euphemism for race, and they can't really deny the evidence that's been revealed by genetic analysis. It's there. There are genetic differences between what men had previously noticed were differences in populations without even knowing that it was DNA. DNA confirmed it. Prior to the discovery of DNA as a hereditary material, scientists actually used blood proteins. This was sort of an intermediate between the metaphorical sense of blood and bloodlines and actually looking at the blood proteins, which they were able to use. And in the development here of an understanding of genetics, the microscope was very important too. That's not really cited in any of these pieces that I've selected here. But I'll just say that up front, that it was people looking through a looking glass to see things that couldn't have been seen before, that revealed a lot of the workings of the cells, the cell division and so forth. And so that they knew at a certain point in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that something was going on in there. And anyway, that ultimately led to a better understanding. Let me start at the beginning of what the Wikipedia page on scientific racism identifies, and because they trace the whole history and give a sort of who's who list of their own about where these racial ideas come from in science, how they're rooted in science, and it starts their list starts back in the 1700s. 1600s, it's 17th century. And I was surprised to discover this, that they cite Robert Boyle as one of the earliest examples. Robert Boyle was a 17th century natural philosopher, a chemist, a physicist, an inventor, also noted for his writings in theology, as I mentioned, a polymath. He's been variously described as Irish, English, and Anglo-Irish because his father moved to Ireland. From England during the time of the plantations. Today, he's regarded as the first modern chemist. He's best known for Boyle's Law. This is the law that relates, if you remember your high school chemistry, relates pressure and volume and temperature of a gas to each other, and how if you change one, then how the other two will sort of compensate. Boyle was a believer in monogenism, about that pronunciation. This is the idea that all races, no matter how diverse, came from the same source. The reason he believed that is because he believed in the literal interpretation of the Bible. He believed the source was Adam and Eve. And he also believed, and this is again citing from Wikipedia, which is thinks this is scandalous, I guess. He studied reported stories of parents giving birth to different colored albinos. He believed that Adam and Eve were originally white and that Caucasians could give birth to different colored races. Also, they cite here, and this is an interesting bit having to do with the others. In his will, Boyle provided money for a series of lectures to defend the Christian religion against those he considered quote, notorious infidels, namely atheists, deists, pagans, Jews, and Muslims, unquote. So here's a hint that Boyle saw Jews and Muslims and pagans. He saw the world primarily in religious terms, not so much in racial terms. But apparently, and they don't really provide much more information than this in Wikipedia, apparently he was notorious enough. He did something that earns him the one of the first slots in scientific racism, mention of that notorious concept. The next person is, and he's not mentioned in scientific racism, this is more of a, just a giant in the field of biology and genetics, is Lamarck. His actual full name was Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, and here the full name actually is Jean-Baptiste Pierre Antoine de Monet Chevalier de Lamarck, one of those outrageously long titled Frenchmen. Often he's simply known as Lamarck, and he was a French naturalist. In 1802, he was one of the first to use the term biology in its modern sense. So he coined the word biology. He's very significant. His contribution to evolutionary theory consisted of the first truly cohesive theory of evolution. And he saw it as an alchemical complexifying force which drives organisms up a ladder of complexity, and then there's a second environmental force which adapts them to local environments through the use and disuse of characteristics, differentiating them from other organisms. And this is key. This use and disuse of characteristics is often called Lamarckism, and the entry for Lamarckism describes that as the idea that an organism can pass on characteristics that it has acquired during its lifetime to its offspring. I remember when I first learned about Lamarck that it was described as, for instance, that giraffes somehow got taller necks by reaching for leaves, and that caused their necks to grow longer, and therefore they passed those longer necks on to their offspring. This has fallen into disfavor. It's was a debate for a long-running debate of whether that was true or not, and it is now considered not true. But Lamarck is a giant in the roots of biology and even genetics, or what led to the ultimate discovery of genetics. The next name I would mention here is Gregor Mendel. Gregor Mendel was a German-speaking Silesian scientist and an Augustinian friar who gained posthumous fame as the founder of a new science of genetics. It was posthumous fame because when he first, most people have heard of Mendel and Mendelian inheritance because of his famous experiment with the pea plants and crossing them. And we know about recessive genes and dominant genes because of the work that Mendel did, although it wasn't appreciated when he first published it in 1865, 1866. It wasn't rediscovered until 1900 or so by biologists working at that time, but they did give him credit for being the first one to discover it. Now, Mendel was working at about the same time that the next... let me mention first here the significant thing about what Mendel discovered was this particulate nature of inheritance, they call it. Particulate or particulate in the sense that it's sort of like quantum mechanics, that genes come or the heritable traits come in these particles and that they're discrete particles and they're either inherited or they're not inherited or passed on. You know, they're either passed on or they're not passed on. And that's the significant thing about him, and that is maybe a little not so intuitive when actually today we know that most inherited traits are actually appear more fuzzy than that because they're actually due to the blended effects of multiple genes interacting. And it's not so simple that it's a single gene. But when he did his work, he, by stroke of luck, or because it was the most obvious thing that he could work with, was working with aspects of the plant that were visible and were due to a single gene, or a single, at least in the case of each change that he was looking at, each difference he was looking at between the plants. Now, Mendel was working at the same time, roughly, as Charles Darwin was working. And everyone's heard of Charles Darwin and his theory, Darwinism. In Wikipedia, he's described as an English naturalist. And he established that all species of life have descended over time from common ancestors, and proposed the scientific theory that this branching pattern of evolution resulted from a process that he called natural selection, in which the struggle for existence had a similar effect to the artificial selection involved in selective breeding. So he took his inspiration directly from this animal husbandry and agriculture that I mentioned at the beginning. He just saw that he sort of made an analogy to nature now, and saw something similar going on in nature, but you know, under the control of nature or nobody really, rather than a farmer deliberately trying to manipulate his livestock. Darwin published this theory in 1859. In a book that was titled On the Origin of Species. Now, he was influenced to come to this conclusion by reading Thomas Malthus, an essay on the principle of population, which was published in 1798, long before Darwin did his work. But it turns out Malthus's work was influential on others as well at about the same time. Most people have heard of Malthusian theory and this idea of geometric progression, that the population increases by doubling over and over and over again until it outstrips the available resources, and then there's a big die-off. That's Malthusian theory. Anyway, when Darwin read about this, he thought, well, how does nature deal with this, and how does let me see if I've copied a section here having to do with what he thought and what inspired him exactly. Darwin saw a similarity between farmers picking the best stock in selective breeding and a Malthusian nature selecting the chance variants. So the difference he saw there was just that nature was doing it by chance as opposed to farmers, which were trying to select deliberately. He later called his theory natural selection, an analogy with what he termed the artificial selection of selective breeding. Later, he published a book. In that first book, he specifically stayed away from the implications on human beings, because even though he had some thoughts on the subject, he avoided it because he thought it was a little bit too politically incorrect for the time. That phrase politically incorrect didn't exist at the time, but it was the, I think, the challenge to Christian dogma that concerned him. And he was criticized very, very, very sternly and widely for his initial publication. But 12 years later, he published another book. This one focused on his theories as applied to human beings. And this was, as Wikipedia mentions, he was not the first one to do that. Other people immediately saw the implications and started debating them for human beings. So he was really kind of late to the argument by the time he wrote this book. And it was titled The Descent of Man and the Selection in Relation to Sex. And in the Wikipedia page on this book, it says... you know, I'm going to ignore the rest of what the book was about, but it says the questions of what, quote, race was, how many human races there were, and whether they could be mixed, were key debates in the nascent field of anthropology in Darwin's time. after the American Civil War, which was 1861, 1865, the questions of race and slavery were brought to the forefront in anthropology in the United States and Europe. Some scientists from the southern U.S. published long monographs on, quote, why the Negro is inferior, unquote, and would soon be driven to extinction by newfound freedom, with an implication that slavery had not only been beneficial but natural. Darwin was a longtime abolitionist who had been horrified by slavery when he first came into contact with it in Brazil while touring the world on the Beagle voyage many years before. Slavery had been illegal in the British Empire since 1833. He considered the race question one of the most important of his day. It goes on to say that Darwin opposed the polygenism theory. Now, I remember I had mentioned the monogism theory, that race arises from a single source, or that all races trace back to a single source. With this polygenism theory developed by scientific racist discourse, which postulated that the different human races were distinct species and were likely separately created. To the contrary, Darwin considered that all human beings were of the same species and that the races, if there were any useful markers at all, were simply subspecies or variants. This view, known as monogenism, was in stark contrast with the majority view in anthropology at the time. I want to insert here and say people might have thought that the races were distinct and separately created because they thought that God had just created all the different species. Up until Darwin's time and around about Darwin's time, that was the prevailing thought, was that God had created everything, and on the seventh day he rested. And there was no speciation, there was no evolution, it was all static. So they had to explain why there were black people and Asian people and white people, and that's how they explained it, by saying that it was polygenetic. It was, they were created separately by God. It finishes up here, this last bit that I want to read here. Darwin viewed the differences between the human races as superficial. He discusses them only in terms of skin color and hair type. Now, I have a feeling that that's a retroactive interpretation of what Darwin actually thought. I think they're just trying to rehabilitate Darwin and say, oh, he wasn't a racist, because he obviously is a giant in biology. And that is really the point here that I'm getting at in reviewing these men and what they thought. These ideas of race go back quite a way. It isn't something that was pulled out of thin air. And it was some of the greatest men of our race, that of the white race, that thought these thoughts. And that has changed. And I think in the second and certainly by the third installment here, I'll explain to you how and why that changed, who changed it. And it should make a lot of sense. It makes sense to me. We'll talk about Carlton Kuhn a little bit, and I have some more to say about him as well, and many other great men.